We believed firmly right from day one that connecting the people behind the product, the story of how the product is made, why it might be relevant in your life, was the way that we presented. It was never a sell. We were just kind of laying out the case in a very kind of neutral and objective way and let customers decide.
Welcome to Babson Built, where we interview Babson founders and entrepreneurs, people who have tried, failed, and tried again.
They're the change makers, the disruptors, the hustlers, and the builders. These are their stories. Hey everyone, this is Alex Kennedy. I'm a Babson MBA and I'm your host for today's episode. And wanted to highlight that this episode is a special makers episode where we brought together the co-founders of The Grommet and a Babson entrepreneur whose product, Detrapel, has also been featured on The Grommet. So we'll explain what all of those things are more in a bit, but just wanted to say that it was a really fun conversation. So hope you enjoy. The Grommet is a place to discover and shop innovative new products from local makers and small businesses. Jules Pieri is the CEO and Joanne Domeniconi is the Chief Discovery Officer. The company turned 10 years old last year and has been featured in Today, New York Times, Fortune, and more. David Zamarin is also here with us and is the founder and CEO of Detrapel, which offers non-toxic water and stain repellent treatments designed to protect your favorite belongings from spills and stains. David graduated from Babson undergrad in 2019, but before that, in early 2018, went on Shark Tank and made a deal with Lori and Mark after quite a bit of drama. Detrapel was also featured and launched on The Grommet in 2017. Jules, Joanne, and David, welcome to Babson Built.
Thank you.
Awesome. So let's just start it off with entrepreneurship. When did you first know, and feel free to chime in whenever, but when did you first know that you wanted to be an entrepreneur?
I'm still deciding. that was not the plan at all.
I always knew that I loved to build things within businesses, but I had a long career in a big company, and it wasn't until I ran into this one next to me that I got turned into a real entrepreneur, that kind of gritty, tenacious one that you need to be to succeed. And so that's where I'm at. How about you, David?
I was, growing up, I had a rough upbringing. My parents got divorced when I was two, both immigrants, so my mom's side of the family had a very, very big push in education, so I had constantly, trying to get straight A's, whatever. And my dad was very business focused, so got a lot of business acumen from him just by, being in his meetings and whatnot when I was in elementary school. And then I was fortunate that I was accepted into one of the best high schools and middle schools as well in the country, which is a public school in Philadelphia. And so I went there and I realized that all my peers were ridiculously genius. And that I was just falling behind, and I didn't know what I was going to do when I was going to be applying for college. And I was involved in like 12 different clubs, doing everything and anything, just trying to figure out what I liked. But I also knew that I had some kind of business interest, even though I wanted to be a lawyer my whole life, from a young age, because I would constantly sell things when my grandma was making like popsicles, for example, when I was in the apartment complex that we used to live in. And I would sell them instead of giving them out for free to my friends. So I always knew I had something in me. And then I got into a youth entrepreneurship program that was offered outside of school, my freshman year of high school. And I took it the most serious out of everyone there because I really, really found my passion, which was entrepreneurship, started a different business, and was fortunate that I had an exit opportunity out of that and then transitioned to Detrapel. So my sophomore year, I made a decision I was never going to be a lawyer and just focus on business.
But this was high school that you started.
This was high school,
right?
Yeah, my sophomore year of high school.
What was that like? I mean, starting a business in high school.
Very difficult, especially one that's very technology focused. And I don't mean software because it's not software, but it's something that is rudimentary in nanotechnology, which is a chemistry. And it was tough. I mean, I wasn't a chemist by trade. I was in high school. I didn't even take chemistry when I started the business. I was fortunate that I took classes at UPenn in chemistry, so that was good. But it was tough because a lot of people didn't believe that it could happen, especially that someone that young could make a business that was proclaiming the claims that we were making about being the safest product on the market in the space, really the only safe product on the market in the space. Everyone kind of shot that down for the very first few years.
Tell us how it works, the Detropel. I mean, how is it the safest product on the market?
It's pretty simple how it works in the sense that you spray it on anything, whether it's a fabric good or even a wall. You let it cure for 24 hours, and then you can pour paint, syrup, water, whatever you want on the surface, and it just rolls right off without any stains. It's pretty simple. And what makes it inherently safe is that it's water-based, and we also do not use any fluorochemicals. So we're the only company in the protective coating space designing any coatings at all that do not have any fluorochemistry whatsoever.
Mm. I did read that it's made from the lotus flower leaf, right? Is that was one of
that's
the...
how it was derived.
So that's non-floral.
It is. Fluorinated chemicals are a family of 5,000 chemicals that are extremely carcinogenic.
Mm.
Some of them are safe, like fluoride, which is in water for water treatment facilities. But other ones like fluorine are incredibly dangerous. All of our competitors' products. So that's the main thing that we do not do.
Got it.
And how is your product different than Scotchgard, which is the one that people would know?
It's our biggest competitor. And the thing is with Scotchgard, if you look up 3M, they're going through massive class action lawsuits. They settled on one in 2016 for, I think it was like $5 billion, because they're purely carcinogenic. They led cancer into 70,000 constituents in the Ohio and West Virginia region because farmers were getting the water stream from their wastewater into their system, and then the cows were drinking it, and the milk and meat was contaminated with fluorinated chemistry, and 70,000 people were contaminated because of it. So it's a massive, massive scandal, and that happened in 20. It was a 20-year affair that the lawsuit was going on, and it finally got settled in 16. And then on September 30th of this year, Rob Bilott, who led the class action for that class action lawsuit, just got another approval to lead a class action with as many as up to 1 million people against 3M, DuPont, and Chemours, which are the three main competitors who actually invented the technology for Scotchgard. So Scotchgard, in a sense, it works similar in the fact that it's, you know, it's a protectant, it's a coating, but it's very different because it's not an ultra-thin coating like we are. So what our coating does is that it combines with a fabric, but it maintains the breathability of the fabric while being safe. And so, you know, for someone who wants to put this on their running gear, for example, and is concerned about the gear kind of having some kind of adverse effect when they sweat, it absolutely has no difference whatsoever, which is the coolest part. There's no change in the texture or color, unlike Scotchgard products. And, of course, it's safe. So those are the main differences.
Has streetwear and athletic wear been, like, a huge growth area? I think
that's our biggest growth area, yeah.
Okay.
Shoes and sneakers, for some reason, which is how I started the business, so I guess there's some relevance there, has been our biggest best-selling product or the most used case. Okay. There are a lot of different verticals because we have products that could be for industrial use or for consumer use. And so for the consumer side, we just launched this week 11 lead SKUs. So we have something for fabric and upholstery, fabric and clothing, shoes and sneakers, suede and nubuck. It's all the same product, just different label.
Say,
it's all the
same
thing.
Product.
We've seen that story before.
Yeah.
But it
same
makes
price.
Sense
same price.
People
we're not,
want
right.
to
yeah.
be sure of what they're using it for.
That and what we've seen
retail
is...
retail presence, too.
Right.
Yeah.
And
oh,
that's,
yeah.
that was the main reason
yeah.
why we did it. It was for sure first shelf spacing, but... the second reason was
wait a
because
minute, that was a gem right there. Don't miss that.
Really?
No, seriously. Think about getting your product on shelf in a retailer, which is a super
important.
Oh,
you
want
to go to a pet store? You need a pet product.
Yep.
You want to go to a houseware store? You want a
mm-hmm.
or furniture store? You want the furniture packaging?
Yeah.
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 But I was also thinking facings, like one single little product.
Could be in multiple aisles.
Multiple aisles, but right next to each other, too.
Yeah.
Just literally taking up visual presence.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Because it's a fairly small product, right?
Yeah, we developed the whole display because it's like literally the idea is what you described. It was primarily driven by retail. And the secondary reason was because most of our target demographic are moms that are, you know, in their 40s, maybe even all the way up to 60s because of Shark Tank.
60s, so old.
Well, they're not old. I'm just saying, all the way up to 60s, because that was our target demographic because of Shark Tank. And what we've seen is that people get fixated because they think, oh, I can use this for my shoes or whatever. And they forget that it could also be used on their couch or, you know, their carpet or whatever. So we just wanted to make it easier. We kept the pricing the same. We're not trying to deceive anyone. It's the same price, same, you know, formulation. It's just different packaging so that you can understand as a consumer, hey, I can also use this for, you know, my carpets as well as my shoes.
Yeah, makes sense. Smart.
Yeah. Cool. So let's switch gears to the grommet a little bit. So do you all mind telling us how that works?
So the grommet is a product launch platform. We are a digital media platform that uses content, you know, and community to bring customers to entrepreneurs, new businesses. So we're focused on consumer products in 16 different categories. And we are serving up stories about interesting products to an audience of about 3 million people every single day. So our promise is subscribe to our email or show up at the grommet and learn about a product you've never heard of before. And we focus on innovative products that solve everyday problems. So trying to be really useful in people's lives by showing them a better mousetrap.
So we launched Fitbit, SodaStream, Detrapel, OtterBox, Well Water Bottles, Idea Paint out of Babson as well. Still very much in use in our office as
Palm
well.
Palm Press is a Babson product. And Mighty
right.
Well.
Mighty
Well.
Mm-hmm.
Babson
Thinkboard.
Product.
Thinkboard.
Thinkboard
yeah.
is a Babson product.
Babson is a gift that keeps on.
Yeah.
It's
true.
No, it's wonderful. And I mean, I'm just going to say, how is it unique? But it really is. I mean, there's Kickstarter and there's Indiegogo, but those are all different. I can't think of anything else that's like the
No, I've said a couple of times, we're either like really onto something or insane because we don't have direct competition. But I do really like the crowdfunding platforms. They're also a great feeder system, and they've also been huge in the ecosystem because they solve a very different problem, like how do we get that first production run going, and then we pick up after that.
Got it.
Yes.
And Detrapel was on the grommet in 2017, right?
That's
so
correct.
You want to just talk about that process?
Oh, it's great. I mean, we there's three tier options from what I remember, right, to choose what kind of platform marketing that you want with the campaign. We chose the second one, which was we submitted our own video, and we had a great launch. We did just under 20,000 in sales, which was awesome, especially for a business that at that time we weren't really doing those kind of numbers. You know, that was pre-Shark Tank, that was pre any retail, you know, before Ace Hardware. And then we got Ace Hardware through the grommet. And even though that was just a few stores, it was our first insight into retail, which was super awesome to get because then we understood what didn't work in retail.
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
To clarify, grommet has partnered with Ace Hardware.
That's
so
what I was going to ask.
Discovery platform. We have an entire team who are kind of looking out at the market, watching consumer trends, watching product trends in each of these 16 different categories or industries that we follow. And we are connected to innovation circles. We work with entrepreneurs. We vet those products. And then we create the media story and present the products to a huge audience. And then what our partnership with Ace Hardware is beautiful because their merchants are managing huge inventories. They're a giant business, $5 billion business at wholesale, and they're managing their inventories. But we're feeding them information on products that are resonating
mm-hmm.
with a broad audience
mm-hmm.
in the United States. And at that point, they bring them into their they bring the products into their stores and potentially and test them.
You know,
I think what an opportunity it is for makers, somebody like company like Detrapel, you know, we are in, you know, this 24 hours, we can reach millions of consumers across the country, the United States. And then if the product is works, we have a super highway right to retail shelves
mm-hmm.
because, you know, as an entrepreneur, you need to kind of have blanket coverage. If you're going to own that territory and claim it for your own, it's a race to find customers and get retail presence.
So what impact have you felt from the grommet and launching there? Yeah, what was the biggest thing that sticks out about it?
Well, I think, you know, the two things I already mentioned were the biggest things that I got out of it, which was one, a really needed influx of cash at the time that we
mm-hmm.
needed it, and just a real look into how not only retail works, but also just how wholesale selling of
mm-hmm.
consumer-based products works too. Because again, it was our first time really selling that kind of level at wholesale, because that was our first time transitioning out of business to business and doing contracts for manufacturers or doing building contracts and transitioning into the consumer world, which is a completely different business and a completely different mindset that you need to have to run that kind of business. And it's just a completely different experience. And the grommet, particularly for my business, really opened up our eyes to how it's done in the very beginning and how to quickly fix the mistakes that we had. So we noticed the mistakes that we had. We knew that, you know, we didn't have a retail-friendly product when we didn't get repeat sales from Ace Hardware. And so we realized, okay, there's two reasons for this. And we called one of the stores and we said, hey, you know, you guys bought some of this product. How's it doing? How's it sitting on the shelf? And they said, well, we put it on some random shelf in this aisle, and it's so small, people just don't see it.
Mm.
And we're like, oh, that makes sense, because they probably need a display for their, you know, for their register. And then we started thinking from there and thinking about more product for less money and getting them, you know, just a better product. And that was really thanks to the Grommen, something that we wouldn't have had without it, because we wouldn't have been in any retailers at that time.
A lot of our makers actually, we do solicit a lot of product reviews also. So a lot of our makers can kind of garner feedback about their product through our user-generated content in the form of reviews.
That's especially helpful with a product like this, because we test everything, but there's a longevity to this product. I felt that really matters in a review. A reviewer who would maybe use it in a way we wouldn't even think of will reflect that. It could be positive, could be negative, but either way, it's learning.
Every entrepreneur starts somewhere. Are you looking for your beginning? This summer, join the top student teams from Babson, Wellesley College, and Olin College of Engineering and accelerate your venture in Blank Center's intensive 10-week summer venture program. Applications are open for this summer's cohort. To apply, please visit babson.edu/svp.
I'm fascinated by the community that you all have built, you know, over 3 million people. Could you just talk about how did you build that and how did it become such a powerful part of, because it is.
That was the hard part, though.
That's the hardest.
There are two sides to marketplace, supply and demand. And the supply part, you know, in terms of brilliant products from interesting companies, companies with really contemporary values, that was a safe bet. Like, we could see that was happening. It's partly a technology story. It's partly a big companies are kind of letting down their guard and not innovating. So we knew there'd be great products. There'd be David showing up, right, with Detropel. But the bet on, like, would anyone care? And how do you find the people who care? That was a much harder bet and much harder to do. That
and expensive.
Super expensive. That's where all the capital goes, right? Like, retailers have, you know, they exist for a reason. They have customers. They have foot traffic. They're marketing.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing lots and lots of things. Moving online is a whole different way of doing some of those same things, but it's not free.
And creating a new brand that people trust is also takes a lot of time, and it does take a lot of capital as well.
So I would say, like, our earliest sort of wins were mostly around PR, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
We were in the New York Times in August
2010.
We were only a couple of years, not even 2 years old at that point. We had a whole page in the Sunday business section. So, you know, certain things like that, actually, as a young company, you have advantages. People want to hear fresh stories. So we used that advantage as much as we could. But, you know, the down and dirty digital acquisition, competing in a crowded world, whether it's Facebook or Instagram or Google, is not something you get for free. Nobody gets it for free. So the direct-to-consumer companies that are very ascendant right now, the Warby Parkers, et cetera, are essentially taking the same dollars they would use to pay a retailer and using them to pay digital rent to Google and Facebook. And we had to do the same.
Mm.
You know, nothing was, it was a brick by brick sort of do the work, like Bill Belichick, do your job. Looking at 200 to 300 products a week to boil it down to 5 or 6, that quality lens is massive. It's a great assurance to people when you've done that kind of work. And then the reality was there. Like, the products work.
Mm-hmm.
Our return rate is under 3%.
I would also say, though, that our playbook is unique, and I'm proud of it. Since 2010, we took a storytelling approach to the way that we connected a consumer to the product. We believed firmly right from day one that, you know, kind of connecting the people behind the product, the story of how the product is made, why it might be relevant in your life, was the way that we presented. It was never a sell. It was never icky. It wasn't traditional. We were just kind of laying out the case in a very kind of neutral and objective way and let customers decide, hey, does this fit in your life? Do you connect with? We were like the shop owner kind of explaining the why of the product. Mm-hmm. Our motto always was, you know, tell, don't sell. Products on shelves can't talk. And the biggest preventer of success for an innovative product is product understanding. So if you can get that through a kind of a media play, create that product understanding and connect them to the people behind the product, you're a long way to getting a customer.
You guys really built, like, a really honest customer base, a customer base that went on the newsletter just to see what, you know, was coming up. And then you would lead to the website and you see all these different products and you feel some sort of trust because it's been vetted by Legrand and it's a product that is cool, innovative and new. And as you continue to do that, you probably just built more and more of a very loyal customer base.
Yeah. Some of that is honestly just like honestly being worthy of being trusted, like having the story straightforwardly, being honest. I like the word you used. And the time we launched, 2008, was a very tumultuous time. Like,
yes.
Everybody was sort of looking for sources to trust. We had some big, big problems happening around us from large institutions. So small business is always high on that. Like, I believe in small business, but we were surfacing it in a very human, but also a contemporary way. If you always center on people and a connection to people and us doing the work as well as connecting to the people who create the products, I think that's, you're betting on what endures as opposed to what changes.
Yeah.
I love that bet.
That's fascinating. Maybe I'm making too far connections here, but I'm just thinking about how you all kind of started out just direct to consumer and then you did explore some wholesale routes. Does that change this conversation around trust at all? Or is it no?
It's all beautifully connected.
Yeah.
I mean, our mission is about creating success for entrepreneurs. We think of our customer community or our consumer community as supporters of the maker. So there's a little shift in mindset that is uncommon in a kind of retail platform play, for sure. So think about this. We're thinking about the maker as our customer. Our mission is to create success for makers. And there's two sides to that equation for a maker. They need to find individual customers that are supporters, but they also need to connect with retailers. And our focus in our wholesale business is the independent small business retail cohort, that Main Street retailer that needs the distinctive, unique, differentiated products to compete with the big box. Mm. So these are two people that really need to be together, this independent small business on Main Street and the independent entrepreneur who's creating products. They need to work together to create differentiation from the big box.
And make that connection.
And we are making this connection.
And Ace fits in there. People might wonder, they may not realize it's a co-op. So all of the stores are individually owned by families. So you mentioned calling a store directly, David. You didn't call like corporate to get feedback. You called the store owner or a store manager to get feedback because you can't with Ace Hardware.
And that was how it was like even possible, because if it was corporate, we would have never gone through.
Yeah,
correct.
Yeah, there's a new threat to trust that's important too. That retailers have always maintained product standards because they want you to come back in the store. So they've always tried to sell the authentic product, products that meet safety and other types of regulatory standards, products that are not counterfeit or, you know, fake or expired. And it's in the news quite a bit right now that Amazon is kind of the opposite of that. And the marketplaces in general as a business model don't have that mission. That's not what they consider to be their job. Their job is to give the platform and kind of let the market
do what it will.
Yeah. Mm. So right now, 40% of what's sold on Amazon comes straight from a Chinese factory, largely in the realm of unsafe, illegal, counterfeit, or copycat. That's a pretty big shift. That's a pretty recent shift on Amazon and not true at retail.
So speaking of business models, so you mentioned that you see the maker as the customer in a way. So is that the primary business model, or do you also take
it? By the way, that is debated in our company. But
really?
Because they don't survive without each other. We have to have consumers supporting the maker. But there's a very strong mindset within our company, and it's stated in our mission that we are put on this earth to help small business succeed.
Do you also take a cut from the sales, just in terms of how you're making money? How does it work?
Sure. Yeah, that's important. You don't get to do what you want to do unless you have a self-sustaining business, right? So, we're paid for performance, if you will.
Mm.
When we sell a product from a maker, we earn a commission or a margin off of that, and it's all kind of papered up front in our partnership agreement, and it's fair, and it works.
That's super important for the wholesale business, because if we were just pure media or somehow pay to play just to like get a presence on our platform, we would have no information about sales and customer experience and reviews and all the things that a retailer, again, because they're building on their own reputation of trust, they're borrowing our credibility. And our credibility comes from people who actually bought the product. Proof A, it's interesting. B, it worked, right? Those things, there's no shortcut to those pieces of information.
And considering that they even, you know, they do their homework on the, it's not just, you can't just sign up as a maker and come on the platform. That's not how it works. You know, I think what that instills is trust in this never-ending loop between the customers, the makers, the grommet, and so on and so forth, to the point where even if, for example, like even in an Ace Hardware program, right, like, yeah, we could call the co-op, we could call the individual store, and we can talk to the store manager, but never did it cross our mind that we would go to them directly as opposed to going with the grommet, because it's just instilled. It's that proper business practice of maintaining a relationship, which is kind of forgotten in today's environment. So, you know, I think that's one of the major things, is that there's trust in a never-ending loop between everyone that's involved.
So we were talking about the grommet's business model, but David, I want to ask you as well. I did some research and saw on your LinkedIn that you said, I have implemented a strategic shift towards a smarter business model that reimagines the way my company builds new consumer products, creates distinction, and contributes to change. So could you talk about that a little more in terms of the smarter business model that you're
Yeah, well, so I think, you know, generally speaking, there are two different types of businesses. Businesses that are fully profits-driven and businesses that are, you know, socially driven. And I think there's this new medium in the last couple of years, maybe the last decade or so, of businesses that are kind of in the middle, like, you know, like what we're doing or what the grommet does.
B-Corps.
Yeah, but also just businesses in general that are for-profit businesses but have a real mission that's at the forefront of their company. And for us, you know, we used to think about what we were doing was a great product and a great innovation, but the change that we were implementing through what we were doing in the manufacturing space was secondary. And in most recent times, the last, you know, 3.5 years or so, really the last 2 years, we made a massive shift in the way that we just thought as a culture, as a company, because we realized that chemical manufacturers have just been full of it for the last 70 plus years, you know, releasing products that are not safe and they knowingly do it. And then 10 years later, there's a lawsuit and they say, oh, we didn't know. We'll take it off the shelf and put a V2 out there. And then they put out the version 2 and 10 years later, same thing happens again. And so, you know, this has continuously happened. And I think we decided that, you know, the mission would be the forefront, but that doesn't mean that profits need to be sacrificed, right? Like, we are a business at the end of the day. And in order to do what we need to do, we need to make profit. And so we decided to stop outsourcing everything, for example. We used to outsource everything. My office used to be, you know, Babson's campus and my dorm room and whatnot. And then, you know, made a very crucial decision to stop that and bring everything in-house, from R&D to manufacturing to packaging to labeling to distribution to fulfillment. And the conscious decision was strictly made not because it would cost more or cost less, but because it was the right thing to do. It was not only a way to bring business and opportunities to other individuals and hire people, which is a whole different aspect of business in and of itself, but also it gave us the opportunity to really own our mission and to really be truthful about what we were saying, because we knew what we were putting in our product this time around. And so, you know, for us, that just meant completely shifting the entire company. Got a space here in Mass, and then we expanded even past that. We started a 4,000 square foot facility in Holliston, and then 6 months into it, we were at a 13,000 square foot facility, which is where we are now in Framingham. The only reason why I say that is because it took this shift to experience that kind of growth, because before that shift, we were experiencing very modest growth. Everything changed for us just because we really made a point to make sure that what we were doing was the right thing in every sense of that word. And even though we make mistakes every day, you know, the mission is true and it's pure. We're trying to really revolutionize an entire industry, because at the end of the day, their companies have misled not only customers, but their own employees for decades.
You're not calling out your competitors, though, for their problems to market your own product directly.
No, we don't.
Why?
Because, and maybe we're wrong about this, but the real reason is I just don't personally right now think that it's worth mentioning someone else's wrongs to make ours a right. Because we're doing what we're doing regardless of what they're doing. If they choose to switch their product and look into a non-fluorinated chemistry, which now they can't because it's patented, but if they could have, would we have, you know, been angry? No, they should be doing that. And we'll compete together. But the fact that they didn't, and we were first to beat them to it, because we want to be honest about what we're doing, that's fine with me.
Someone will buy you.
We'll see.
I don't think everyday customers know that Scotchgard is unsafe.
Well, we're still educating them. We're not saying that we're not completely ignoring them. There's a whole section on our website called PFAS Chemicals, and it calls all of our competitors out,
okay,
but not by name. yes, we do talk about it. It's just, it's not something where we walk around, and I have said Scotchgard publicly all the time. It's just, it's not something that I need to do every time.
So you all have been so successful in your careers, and you at a very young age. What, I'm curious from all of you, what are you most proud of? And on the flip side, what have been some of your biggest challenges?
There are a couple things that come to my mind right away. And that was hiring the staff that I have. Because for me, when people look at our team, it's very lopsided because we have one other person, two other people in their 20s. Everyone else is in their 40s. We have someone in their 60s. We have like our 61-year-old member of the team is our head of R&D, for example. So for me, it's two-sided. One, I'm very proud that we can employ people like that that are amazing and super smart, and you know, I like to learn from them. But on the flip side, it's also really humbling to know that they trusted me for whatever reason that it has to join the company and take massive pay cuts, because we've all done that. The team has been one of the most impressive things that we've been able to build, and the people that we have around us.
I'm on a similar theme about creating jobs, and it would be within our you two. I mean, it's so fundamental and rewarding, like jobs in the company and then jobs within our maker community as well. You know, we've created way more jobs outside of our company than inside our company. And they're good jobs, and they're working on things that matter. So that's very satisfying. I'd say a little personal one would be that I have three sons who are grown, as does Joanne, and I'm kind of career person, like consultant to those young men and women.
Career whisperer.
That feels good. It feels good to also have that translate into my own family. Because at the end of the day, we worked so hard, and we spent many years AWOL in some ways from home, and our children are proud of us. Their friends know us.
Yeah, I mean, we have some wisdom that we're imparting, and they're super appreciative.
Yeah. We've
devoted a lot to building this business, a superhuman effort over 11 years. But when it comes right down to it, you know, we think about it being mothers too. This is, you know, special and different. We have a very young team, almost 100 people, and we take huge pride in their growth and development and success. Besides building the business and building a business that you're proud of, that's huge too, but it's the people too. People, mostly.
It always comes back to that. Humans. Great. Well, what about challenges? Are there any big ones that come to mind?
There are a lot of challenges. I could spend a day on the challenges, and you go through tough times when you're kind of doubting your own ability to get to that next, you know, plateau of learning or leading. I think balancing your own health and your business competency and your family is challenging. Making sure you have time for yourself and you feel good about those three buckets of your life. And I extend that to friends, the time you're able to give to the friends and people that you love outside your family. I think, you know, running a company, the people are good, but sometimes you absorb a lot of their problems. You take them home with you. You don't sleep. If we have to make changes or things like that, that's hard. And making sure you're the right leader for the time, you know, that's worrisome too.
Got it. Jules?
I agree with all those, but my one is it was super hard to finance this business, especially during the economic crisis. That about killed us.
Yeah.
And me. That was super hard. We had to survive in a starvation level of resources for 4 years. And I think every business should have one or two of those years, but 4 years is exceptional. And it was exceptionally impressive what the team did during that time.
That sounds very difficult. What's your challenge?
I definitely echo that. Yeah, I would say it actually heads back into the business model and everything that we've done, because for a long time we were always challenged on, even now with our most recent funding round, number one question has always been, you know, business model. You know, you're doing B2B, direct-to-consumer, and retail, which are all three different business models in a sense. Why are you doing that? Why not pursue one or the other? And in reality, I mean, you go where the money goes, and we had an opportunity to do something in the B2B space, and then we found a better way to do something in the consumer space, so we did that. And other than production, you know, everything else has been automated. And so, like, for example, all of our outreach, all of that's very strategic, all the communications, and that's very strategic, very automated. And I think that was a particular reason why we were able to achieve targeting multiple industries, even when we were a little too young for it.
Great. Curious if you all have some advice for early entrepreneurs.
I would say think really hard about what makes your business distinctive and creates a competitive moat,
mm-hmm.
and only do that. Let everything else be partly done or not done at all, because you're going to drain your resources across. Don't be peanut butter. Like, go laser focused on what would stand up at the end of the day.
And prove that concept first.
I love that.
Yeah. Pick your co-founder carefully. It's harder than a marriage, as hard as a marriage.
Yeah,
yeah,
mm-hmm.
It really is. And
I have a bias for a two-person co-founding team.
Mm-hmm.
Just as I think you can do it with one, but it's going to be harder than maybe, like, we would balance each other out on the ups and downs in a nice way. I think three, it's hard to have accountability. Four,
mm-hmm.
forget it. Like, this is a stupid idea.
I can't emphasize the ups and downs, because she'll know, you know, Jules will know, like, you hit periods of time where you just hit a wall and a low energy, or, you know, kind of a frustration. And somehow you get somebody there that can, like, pick up the slack when you're struggling. And we've had those periods, and I've appreciated it.
It's amazing.
You're all by yourself.
I was a solo founder, yeah.
Solo founder.
Now I have my COO who's running side by side. But
sounds like you have strong.
Yeah, I think I have a very strong team. I wasn't a solo founder by choice. Like, I tried getting co-founders. My issue was that I was the only one that was truly dedicated to it. And for me,
mm-hmm.
I was in a unique state, because I was willing to forego having a social life, willing to forego having a traditional college life. I didn't have any of that. And I was willing to do that. And I think I have a very cynical piece of advice for early entrepreneurs all the time, especially if they're not younger entrepreneurs. Because at the end of the day, entrepreneurship, it's not all the fun and games that it seems like. It's a lot of negative roads. And it's not built for everyone. Not everyone should be an entrepreneur.
So last question, it can be just your gut reaction. How much do you feel that your success is attributable to luck, and how much, on the other hand, to skill and hard work?
It sounds like being a jerk to say, like, you know, it's hard work or it's your smarts. But I don't feel like we had an exceptional amount of luck. I do feel like the hard work was the very first thing. And I would have loved to have more, you know, just pure
viral lift. Everybody was talking about viral lift. I'm like, we never got any of that.
I heard every single customer. Yeah. No,
you make
question.
Luck. I think we were fortunate to get Rakuten. And when that was a long shot, people wouldn't have believed that could have done that. But I wouldn't call it luck. Would you?
No.
Got it. What about you, David?
Yeah, I have to ask, I really don't believe the traditional word of luck. I think everything that you do from a business perspective is premeditated.
Mm.
So I believe in premeditated luck, or luck that you've worked to get. I was lucky that I met my co-founder in one sense, but I also was accepted into Mass Challenge that I applied and really went hard for to get into. And then I'm the one that reached out to the co-founder, to my COO anyway.
Got it. That's great. Well, that is very interesting perspectives all around. This has been a wonderful conversation. Jules, Joanne, David, thank you so much.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of Babson Built. You can subscribe on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. Please rate and review us, since that really helps others discover the podcast. You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at Babson eShip, and on Facebook at Babson Entrepreneurs. We're grateful to the Babson College student and alumni founders who participate in this podcast. These are their stories. Join us again for more Babson Builds.